This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, the creator of the first community program credited with preventing a suicide bombing, Gwen Griffith Dixon, gives a new perspective to the war on terror as she discusses how England's program to de-radicalize young people on campuses could become a model for preventing recruitment by extremist groups. Since the 9/11 attacks, many of us have felt a deep frustration that the so-called war on terror seems to have had a limited degree of effectiveness. We want to feel safe and free from fear of violence. But what if it wasn't a better war that we needed, but more peace building? With a background in philosophy and theology, Professor Gwen Griffith Dixon may seem to be an unlikely counterterrorism specialist. Her organization, the Lokahi Foundation, based in England, runs programs which seek to find common ground between police and the Muslim communities. She facilitates workshops in which both groups role play and try to gain a mutual understanding. The program has had measurable success, credited with preventing an imminent suicide bombing.
Well, I'm a professor originally of religion and philosophy, and I didn't really willingly get into the whole area of terrorism and extremism. I worked in interfaith work and built up a lot of trust with the Muslim community, which meant that police and various people kept trying to approach me to get me involved, and I just wanted to run 100 miles away from it. But eventually, I did start a non-profit, and after the attacks we had in 2005, I ended up feeling it was something I really needed to do to try and reduce the threat that we all faced. But that also included the real sort of difficulties and traumas the Muslim community was facing in what used to be called the War on Terror. So I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into it. But one thing that I did was to create programs to bring together police and minority communities, in this case, the Muslim community in particular, because the situation between them was very fraught with suspicion and mistrust. And I thought, well, this is a particular area that we need to do something about.
It's so interesting that you came to anti-terrorism, or whatever you want to call your work, peacemaking, terrorism prevention. It's so interesting that you came from this field of community building and understanding of faiths and cultures, because I think a lot of us feel that fighting terrorism is political, it's a military issue, it's a diplomatic issue. You came to this from a very different position.
Yes, I really came to it from we need to empower communities position. And I think one of the lessons many people, including the police, had learned in England, in Great Britain, was that communities defeat terrorism, and they learned that from the Irish experience. And I was also struck by how what the Muslim community was going through, the Catholic and the Irish communities had gone through only a very short while before in Britain. And it really could be, anyone in some way. There's not some unique problem with Islam or with Muslim communities. It really is a political issue. But I was really determined for a sort of a justice point of view from peace building and getting ordinary people involved in trying to right the problems. And that really has colored my whole approach. And a lot of it has been in the different areas I've worked has been about giving people skills that are useful in everyday life, actually, which are the same skills they need, say, for a young person to resist getting pulled into a gang or pulled into drugs, or the same problem you might have with being bullied by someone in your office, or all the kind of techniques you need to resist being recruited to a violent movement. That was a bit of a surprise, but it didn't really work.
It's so easy after an incident of terrorism kind of hits home to look at the people who perpetrated it, to start to marginalize them, and to kind of start hating on, thinking of people, other people of their faith or political bent, as being all the same and all bad. I mean, I think this is just a place that the mind goes. But you take a very different look at how we can combat that attitude and that sort of reaction that most of us have. I mean, it's very easy to get angry after you see innocent people being shot down for seemingly no reason other than to create terror.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very natural. It is very natural.
Yeah.
And all our instincts are to protect, and therefore for many of us, to protect by going after the people we think are the evildoers. It is a very natural human reaction. It's kind of a very primitive reaction in our brains. And when we are that emotional, we don't think well and we don't think clearly. And our judgments and our perceptions can actually be distorted by, technically you'd have to call it faulty reasoning. If we looked at, say, slavery or the mass shootings in America, and then maybe something going on, Nazism maybe in Europe, and we did the same move, we think, what's wrong with white people? There's a massive problem with being white. And, of course, those people who are white don't see it like that. We see these are completely disconnected, completely different causes. We don't make it a problem about white people or a problem about men, you know, committing acts of violence. But if you're not a member of the group, it's easy just to attribute everything to all the members of the group, which is really untrue. Unfortunately, it's also really unhelpful, and it tends to make the problem worse. In England, we see very clearly a dynamic that's working here, where the far-right racist group and some of the extreme violent Muslim groups use each other actively in recruiting. They point to the other side and see, these people hate you, see, they're out to get you, you have to defend yourself, you can't be at peace with these people, both sides using exactly the same thing, and each time one of them does something provoking, the other side uses it to recruit. It's really crude, but it's very true, and that's, I think, the pattern we have to resist, all of us getting polarized like that and just whipping up the hatred at both extremes.
You're right. It is easy to see it when others do it to us, but in reverse, it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, it's always harder to see ourselves,
yeah,
isn't it?
We forget that they say all Americans are like this. All mm-hmm. Christians are like this. All Westerners are like this.
Mm-hmm.
But describe a little bit more about the group you were working in at the time that your work was able to prevent a suicide bombing that could have been quite catastrophic.
Yes, we were working on a police program to bring together police and communities. And we actually took them away on a weekend. It was quite expensive at the time. I think it'd be hard to get anyone to pay for it now, but they would actually pay for a hotel, a nice hotel, and take 50, 60 people away. And we wrote two stories, effectively, is what we did, kind of like the power of storytelling.
When you say a group of people, describe who you took.
We would take a group of police officers of all ranks, ideally from the most senior down to young cadets, and then we take as wide a spread from mostly Muslim communities as we could, different ethnic groups, different age groups, different denominations, different parts in power structures, and we'd take them all away for a weekend. And we'd have big groups that would break into small groups. And what we would do is we had a story, two stories. One was from the point of view of a police officer, what they call a senior investigating officer in charge with handling a potential terrorist event as it starts unfolding and the first bits of information come in and you have to react and decide if it's nothing or if it's important. And meanwhile, we also took a story that was also very realistic about a young youth worker who was beginning to have some doubts or concerns about some young people. In both cases, it was very realistic in one thing in particular, which is that it could be nothing, it could be normal, it could be nothing to be worried about, or it could actually be the first signs you're getting of a terrorist attack about to unfold. And that is a horrible decision to face for anyone, whether it's someone in the community thinking, do I turn someone in who might be innocent? Or from someone saying, as a police officer, do I overreact and create a backlash? Or do I let this one go and then people die? So it's a horrible dilemma. And so we have the story unfold in stages, and at each stage they have to stop and take a decision about their options, what to do next. And that we do in small groups where the whole group effectively would role play all together, and they'd all have to be that officer, or they'd all have to be someone in the Muslim community with plenty of coaching, you know, about points of the law and what you are and allowed to do or not allowed to do as a police officer. But also stories come out around the table and people would talk about their experiences and how they affected them and or, you know, the police officers say, I'd do this, and the whole rest of the table's going, no, you'd never do that. As a Muslim, you'd never do that. Or, you know, someone, the Muslim would say, well, shoot down the airliner. Police saying, we can't do that. So they kind of bonded around the table, even when they came to it really seriously distrusting each other. Well, one particular weekend we were doing this, there was a young man whose story actually was exactly that of the story we'd written. We had no idea. No one else had any idea. But he really did not trust the police. And there was someone he was uneasy about, but couldn't really put his finger on very much. The guy was saying things he was angry about, foreign policy in America and England. But then lots of young people are. It's not really a, you know, it's not a crime, is it? And he had marks, like burn marks on his fingers, but he said he was a chemistry student, so it happened in the lab. He had a, you know, an explanation for all these little things. And so there was no way that this guy would shop him to the police, because he would ruin someone's reputation, get them in trouble, and he had no proof. So when he came on this weekend, he was basically found everyone role-playing his real life, which must have been a really strange experience. We had no idea what was happening at the time.
So this guy was presumably building bombs back in his apartment or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's what eventually was discovered. Because when he role-played it out, when he watched the police saying how they'd handle it, if someone brought them information, he realized, oh, that's not bad. Oh, I could live with that. Plus, he built relationships and trust, which was the real aim of this weekend. And so at the end of it, he came forward and said, well, I'm not too sure about this guy. And they said, no, actually, this sounds quite serious. And so they mounted a raid and found a suicide vest hanging in the closet. They found explosives in a takeout container in the fridge, and they found the detonators in his kitchen drawer. He was about 24, 48 hours away from blowing up a shopping mall.
Do you think coming on this weekend was his higher self saying, maybe this is unnecessary, or do you think he had another motive?
From what I understand, I think he was kind of dragged there. The mosque was kind of tasked with, you know, bring as many young people as you can. And, of course, no one really wanted to go. Not the way, you know, a young person wants to spend their weekend cooped up, their weekend with police officers thinking, why am I here? So, but the mosque reputation kind of depended on it. And they all kind of thought, no, we really have to get people to turn out for this and show we're willing. So most of the young people there were kind of pressured to be there. And it turned out actually to be a really kind of great and fun weekend, which surprised all of them. So it was, I don't know, if you believe in a higher power or you believe in a God or a universe, it was definitely some higher force, if you believe in that, was guiding it all. Because the odds against it are just amazing.
Your work in the UK to de-radicalize is very centered around the young people that you're talking about. And you found that working on college campuses is a very effective way to shield young people from being recruited to extremist groups.
That's right. And we found we're a little bit countercultural in some ways. And I think, you know, the more difficult things get, the more people want the kind of hard-hitting solutions. And we think the hard-hitting solutions tend not to work so well. So our approach was really to give young people the skills that they need and the experience and the knowledge they need to recognize people who are going to have a negative or destructive effect, and to learn kind of tactics and techniques to deal with it, how to manage their campus events. It's a big thing for students to kind of, or in student societies, to organize speakers coming in. Sometimes those speakers are not really helpful or actively destructible. So we gave them the skills to kind of manage those events well, deal with kind of aggressive hecklers. And it was really a very popular program. And I think the skills are something I wish I had at 19, how to identify that destructive person and just kind of neutralize their effects and protect yourself from dangerous or manipulative relationships and people.
Well, when you were young, you were living in Hawaii. You grew up there and you were exposed to many different faiths and cultures and something called lokahi, which you still embrace today. Explain what that means and how you think it could be realized in our world.
That's a wonderful, wonderful Hawaiian concept. And it means a harmony and creativity that can come together from diverse people, different backgrounds, different skills, different walks of life, coming together to work together for something. It's a kind of broader word for balance or harmony. We sometimes just say harmony from diversity. And that's really the Hawaiian ethnic religious experience that I grew up with. It's a very multiracial place. Of course, there's tensions, but much less than in many other places. And a lot of affection, a lot of good-natured teasing along ethnic lines. But basically, to me, it was just an inspiration and a model for how we can be a really complex and diverse society, and it's so much richer than everyone being the same, whether that's a religion or an outlook or a political view or an ethnic background. It's just so much richer and even just so much more fun. You know, even just think of the foods you can eat in a diverse community. And that was really what I carried with me without, I suppose, appreciating it. It often is in your youth. You just take for granted how things are. And I came to other places and thought, this is what we need. We need that appreciation for diversity. I recognize that people are very attached to their own traditions and backgrounds and ways of life and can feel threatened if they think they're going to be swamped, to use those negative words that politicians can play on. But actually, we can really appreciate and celebrate our own backgrounds, our own views and ways of life, and also still embrace the differences from other people and share in those and enjoy having those around us and having those other ideas and resources to draw on at times.
It does start to seem like the person-to-person, human-to-human approach, community-to-community, is kind of the only answer. I mean, the other stuff we're trying isn't really working too well, it would seem.
No, it tends to create a backlash.
Yeah.
It tends to kind of create a kind of maelstrom or sucks everything into it. And certainly whether you're talking on the local level, the only way to turn aside a young person who's being attracted to something destructive or violent is that person-to-person approach. And I just look at ISIS and people say Islamic State, so-called, and people are saying ever younger people, teenagers, are being attracted to it. They're getting messages on Twitter constantly from recruiters. Why? What's the attraction for something that's even more violent than Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda is saying these people are too violent for us. And yet even younger people are being attracted to it. And I look at the fact that the people that they're attracting now are the ones that grew up entirely in the shadow of 9/11. And so a whole generation of young people, no matter how well their parents have tried to bring them up, have had this background message that there's something wrong with who they are. There's something wrong with a key feature of their identity. They're a problem, they're a threat, something needs to be done about them, there have to be programs about them. And even if their parents have tried to give them different messages, it must just sink in. It must sink in that the broader society thinks you're an issue, and then lately they're hearing they shouldn't be in this country at all. Whereas what they get from the Islamic State people is love bombing. They'll get like 40 messages a day, you know, on their Twitter account from someone who's saying, you're important, you're valuable, we need you to build a new future in a new country, and there's a great sisterhood, and we're all together on this, and you can marry a jihadi hottie, and you can marry a real kind of strong man, and you can have a sort of romance with someone who's making a better place out of the world. And they're being constantly told that they're valuable and they're needed in society, and we don't do that. It's not just young Muslims we don't do that to. A lot of our young people are not getting that message. But it's not even so much brainwashing, I think. It's almost love bombing. And it's happened to a generation of young people that were devalued, I think, by wider society. I don't think it's a coincidence.
It's easy to see what would be attractive about that to young people, the way you describe it, because they're idealistic still. They are trying to figure out who they are, their values. They see problems around them, and they want to be part of the solution. I think young people share that instinct to want to see reforms and justice. But clearly, violence is not the answer. Your work in countering violent extremism led you to write a novel about this field and these themes that we've been talking about. Describe the book, if you would.
Yes, it's called Bleed Back. And I really wrote it at first as just a way of coping with being in this particular world and this particular area of work that I really did not want to be in and can be very disturbing. And in the end, I felt I just had to go public with it. And it describes the war on terror and the impact on different communities through three different characters and their points of view. And I wanted to highlight really a number of things. And one is that what we do in countries abroad, which we tend not to notice, or we see in totally good terms, does come back and bleed back, as the title is. It does bleed back at home, and it does affect people back at home. And a lot of what we do abroad is not really in the interest of those countries. It's in what some of our politicians think are maybe in the national interest. But one of the things that really, on a moral level, just revolted me was that when I began to discover how much money was being made by people from the war on terror, people were literally making billions. Very small elite were making billions. And American, British soldiers were suffering horribly and being horribly traumatized. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were dying. We haven't made Iraq stable now in the long term. And we haven't made ourselves safer, but some people have made a hell of a lot of money, if you'll excuse my language. And that kind of morally affronted me. So I ended up writing it in the form of a thriller, as if it was like one of those Cold War Soviet West thrillers, so that people would kind of be lured into reading it, page-turning, full of suspense and plot twists. But really, there is a deep message I wanted to get out about compassion and understanding the impact of these events on all parties, and understanding the different points of view, and dealing ultimately with the question, is there a redemption possible in all this? Can people change and be redeemed and find compassion, and then themselves begin to act with compassion? That was my deeper, I suppose, spiritual theme.
Is that compassion your hope for the future of work to turn back violent extremism?
Yeah, that's my big hope. As my sort of hero character says, basically, love has only two tactics, forgiveness and compassion. Everything else, you know, evil can match. But compassion is the one thing that evil doesn't have a retort for. And it can be very, very difficult, but it's also one of our deepest impulses. So that's my kind of hope for the human race, is learning how to tap into that empathy. That's what that program that prevented the terrorist attack did. It brought people who didn't want to empathize into that position where they could see each other's point of view and how difficult it was, and to care about what other people were going through. And then all the changes happened on the ground. I only highlighted the one success, but it changed the behavior of police and Muslim communities all over Britain. And similarly with individuals, we need to see, we need to get it, and then we need to care. It's a kind of simple formula, really. That's my hope for the human race.
Gwen Griffith Dixon. Her novel, based on her work in terror prevention, is called Blowback. It will be published later this year. For more information on the Lokahi Foundation, visit lokahi.org.uk. Thanks for joining me today. You can email the show, log on to morefmphilly.com, and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.